Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk, given by Lama Kathy Wesley, is entitled Beyond Belief and Disbelief, Part 2, The Four Seals of Buddhism. Many people struggle with Buddhist concepts such as impermanence and interdependence. But what beliefs are basic to all Buddhists? And is it all right to be a Buddhist and agnostic about these things? In this second part of the series on Buddhist belief, Lama Kathy reviews the Four Seals, a basic teaching of the Buddha that is said to be the mark of all teachings that lead to enlightenment. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Okay, good morning. Thanks to everybody for being here today. I have a couple of announcements at the beginning here, just so we can kind of stay organized. First things first, thank you for coming. And second thing is the Easter Bunny has brought kosher candy for Passover.
Y'all need to be picking these up before you leave.
And please pick them up before you leave. If you have young people in your life, even if these young people are in their 60s or 70s, please take advantage of the kosher candy and take them to the people you love. And thank you to the Easter Bunny. I really appreciate the Easter Bunny comes to visit us every year. So it's, you know, so in any case, thank you. Additionally, do we have any first-time visitors today? It's like, hey, thanks for coming. Yeah, thank you for being here. I like to say that some people come to us and say, I've become disillusioned with organized religion, and then I say, who says we're organized? So I would say it's one of the features of our community that we're open and welcoming, and that we try to help as best we can to connect people to the teachings of the Buddha. So thanks very much for bringing your sincerity here today and for being part of our group meeting today. I know that on days like this, especially because many of our families either are observing Christian holiday or the Jewish holiday, there's going to be a lot of people who are away today to be with their families, and I think that's wonderful. And I also want to thank the team here for coming in and setting up the shrine and taking care of the room and the setup, and then also the sound and recording. This teaching will be made available via recording on our podcast system. So also thanks to the podcast team for making that possible. So today, this is a continuation of a teaching that I started a few weeks ago that I called Belief and Disbelief. Because I was talking about how some folks feel that Buddhism is a dogmatic tradition. And as a dogmatic tradition, it sort of demands specific beliefs. And so I talked a little bit about how our youth and childhood and our past experiences with beliefs form us. And how when we come to Buddhism, whatever we disliked about the, thank you so much, about the, you know, caffeination is very important, thank you. Whatever bothered us about the church of our childhood will probably bother us about Buddhism as well. And so if we have any leftover objections or spiritual wounds from the church of our childhood, we will more than likely bring it with us into the teachings of the Buddha. and our feelings and so forth will, there will be a bit of a confrontation for us as we confront the objections that we've always held toward faith traditions and spiritual traditions. I once met a woman who was really a great seeker of faith, and she told me when I met her that she had already tried and discarded many, many different paths. And she said, I hope that Buddhism will not disappoint me. And I said, well, I may have some bad news for you. It could be that what is causing some difficulty for you is the fact that that you have a difficult time trusting in yourself and in your ability to practice any tradition. It's not necessarily the traditions that are at fault, but perhaps what will, it's not, and it's not even that you are at fault. It's just that you have to engage enough with the faith tradition to work with and engage and work through the objections that you have about faith and spiritual practice. If you can engage and work with those, then this will help you to find a home in some tradition. It doesn't have to be ours, but it can be wherever you feel that you have been able to begin healing yourself of what you and giving yourself what you need. So I basically challenged her to work on gaining confidence in herself as well as confidence in the practice of meditation. So I'm hoping that all has gone well for her since then. So that's what we started talking about the last time in our conversation about belief and disbelief. And at the end of my talk, I said that I would like to spend the second lecture of this two-part series talking about what are the basic beliefs of Buddhism, what constitutes a Dharma path, what constitutes a path that leads to liberation. Because many people, when the Buddha was living 2,500 years ago in India, people would come to the Buddha and they would ask him questions. And in fact, all of the teachings of the Buddha we have today, these sutras as they're called, are often the spoken answers that the Buddha gave to specific questions. And one time he was asked, okay, Buddha, you're so smart. How did this world come into being in the first place? And he answered with a parable. He said, if I am shot with an arrow, my first thought is not going to be, I wonder what was the appearance of the face of the woman who was the mother of the person who shot me. He said, my concern is going to be pulling out the arrow and ending my suffering. Just so, he said, my teachings do not endeavor to answer the question, how did this world come into being? He said, my teachings are about recognizing suffering and bringing it to an end. And so the Buddha taught what are called the four truths known by the noble, that suffering is part of life, that suffering has a cause, that suffering has a solution, and that there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. These four truths form the basis and the framework for all Buddhist study and practice. The theory of Buddhism is that all human beings have the potential both to cause suffering for themselves and others and to bring about happiness for themselves and others. In other words, all human beings possess the potential for both suffering and happiness, and that our thoughts, words, and actions influence our experience in this world. The Buddha's teaching, as outlined in the first chapter of his Book of Sayings, called the Dhammapada. In the first chapter of the Dhammapada, he says we have a choice. He said if we grasp and cling to things, particularly to perceived injuries, then we'll suffer. Whereas if we're able to let go, then we will experience freedom from suffering. He said we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make our experience of the world. And if we think, speak, and act with a pure mind, happiness follows us. And if we think, speak, and act with an impure mind, suffering follows us. The pure mind versus the impure mind, according to his teachings, are the pure mind is a mind that is not grasping and clinging to a self-concept. It's a non-grasping, non-clinging mind. And the mind that is grasping and clinging, particularly to one's self-concept, the selfish mind, is the mind that causes harm. If we go back and look at the examples of our own life, we will see that when something hurt so much, it was probably because we were holding on so tightly. And the path of the Dharma is about letting go. Even the simple practice of quiet sitting meditation, this mindfulness practice that so many people are learning now, I think that humanity's karma is going in a good direction. More people are learning mindfulness now than ever before. So when people say the world is hopeless, I say, I don't know about the world, but I think people have the potential to get better. So this mindfulness that people are learning is about learning to let go of thoughts, feelings, and emotions in the moment while we're sitting. I'll bet everybody in this room has had this experience. You're sitting there and observing the breath as part of your meditation, and then a thought arises, and for a moment it captivates you. And while it's captivating you, you're living in the world of that thought. I know a lot of people talk about the Buddhist concept of rebirth and all of this, but you can be reborn right there, right here, right now, in this life that we have right now, based on what thoughts you choose to believe in. And when we're sitting and meditating, and then we can let go of that thought and return our attention to the breath for a fresh start in our meditation, the world that was created by that thought, that negative clinging thought, disappears. And so that is an illustration of the truth of the Buddha's words. So that's a little bit about what we talked about last time. That's a brief summary. And now today, we're going to talk about, everybody knows the Four Noble Truths: suffering, its cause, its solution, and the path of learning how to let go through the practice of meditation. But now we're going to talk about the true basic beliefs that all Buddhists share. No matter how many, there are hundreds and thousands of Buddhists around the world, millions of Buddhists around the world, and they follow all kinds of different methods of meditation taught by the Buddhist masters of the past. So people say, how many kinds of Buddhism are there? I say, well, how many kinds of Protestant Christianity are there? I bet we're getting close to the same number. There are lots, but they all share four beliefs in common, and I'm going to talk about those today. So there will be audience participation momentarily, but to begin with, I'm going to start with a short prayer. If you know this prayer, you can join in. But if this is a prayer with which you're unfamiliar, don't worry. You can join in your heart and in your mind, and think that you dedicate this short time that we're going to be together this morning to the benefit of all suffering beings. This is the four-line refuge prayer from the Chenrezi text. O sanje chudan soji chonam la jang chu pardu dani kyap su chi da ji jin so ji be sunam ki Drola Penshi Sanjay Druparsho. O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chiwor Pede Ten Shula Kajren Jembo Gune Je Sun Te Ko Sun Tugging A Drup Sal Du So. Okay, thank you. I want to give credit where credit is due. I'm going to provide this link on in my next blog that I write for the columbusktc.org website. It's called The Four Seals of Dharma Are Buddhism in a Nutshell. It's an article reprinted from Tricycle Magazine a number of years ago. And so I'm basing my remarks on this teaching by Zongzhe Khyentse Rinpoche. And I think that it's kind of a good thing to have that. I decided that since it was Easter, we were going to have a small bit of audience participation today. This will kind of be lost on the podcast audience, so I hope you guys all who are listening on the podcast will bear with me. But underneath the front of one of the flat cushions, I'm looking for four small letters small pieces of paper. They're under the front of, if you are sitting next to a cushion and it's not under your cushion, please locate your, there's one. Okay, so you get one. Hold on to it. Yeah, hold on to it. We'll use it later. There's one, we have two, we have three, now we got one, find one more. We have four, okay. I'd like for you to hold on to please hold on. Do you really want to be generous and give it to someone else? Okay, Jeremy gets to hold it for you. All right, there you go. Yeah, let the record show that our shrine keeper is the purveyor of a letter. Okay. The reason I wanted to do this is that I wanted to give everybody the opportunity to sort of own and internalize these four seals. Before I have you read them, I'm going to have you read them one by one and then make comments on each one. But I'd like to read a little bit to you directly from Zongzhe Khyentse Rinpoche's article so that you understand the context of these four statements. People often ask me, what is Buddhism in a nutshell? Or they ask, what is the particular view or philosophy of Buddhism? Then Khyentse writes, unfortunately, in the West, Buddhism seems to have landed in the religious department, perhaps even in the self-help or self-improvement department. And clearly, it's in the trendy meditation department. He says, I would like to challenge the popular definition of Buddhist meditation. Many people think meditation has something to do with relaxation, about being carefree and letting go and like being on a day at the beach. He said, from a Buddhist point of view, meditation is slightly more than that. And then he said, I think we need to talk about the real context of Buddhist meditation. This is referred to in Buddhism as the view, the meditation, and action. These three topics, view, meditation, and action, are what he's introducing here. View is the philosophical underpinning to the meditation that we do. You understand there's a world view. This we are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. That's a view. Our view is that the mind is the creator of our experience. And this is why the Buddha said it didn't matter who created the world or how the world came into being. What matters is how our world comes into being through what we think, say, and do. That's a view. Meditation, then, is how we meditate based on that view, meaning that we learn how to let go of thoughts in order to be able to work with and engage our thoughts rather than having our thoughts be our boss. And then the action is how we act based on the understanding of the view and the meditation. Does that make sense? And so this is what he's talking about here. Taken together, he said, view meditation and action constitute a skillful way of understanding the path of the Buddha. Even though we may not use such expressions as view, meditation, and action in everyday life, if we think about it, we are always acting according to a certain view, a certain internalized meditation and action. And then he uses a mundane example. He says, for instance, if we want to buy a car, we choose the one we think is best, most reliable, and so on. So the view in this case is the idea, the belief that we have that the car is a good one. Then meditation is contemplating and getting used to the idea, and the action is actually buying the car, driving it, and using it. This process is not necessarily something Buddhist. It's something we're doing all the time. You don't have to call it view, meditation, and action. You can think of it as idea, getting used to the idea, and adopting or obtaining. And then he said, Buddhism is based on what are called the four seals. And by that, he means like authenticity. The four seals are found in a path or philosophy. It doesn't matter whether you call it Buddhist or not. You can call it what you like. The words Buddhist or Buddhism are not important. So he said, what is the particular view that Buddhists try to get used to? Buddhism is distinguished by four characteristics or seals. It doesn't matter whether they're from a Buddhist path or a non-Buddhist path. That's why they are universal. He said the Buddha just, he just spoke about them. And so he's going to go into explaining what the four are. So who has number one? Who has number one? Would you care to read that out loud, and then I'll repeat it.
All compounded things are impermanent.
All compounded things are impermanent. Okay, that's the first of the seals. I'm going to have all four of them read once through, and then we'll go through each one individually. Where's the second one? Jeremy, please read the second one.
All emotions are painful.
All emotions are painful. See, some of these are challenging the way they're stated. Where's number three? Marilyn?
All phenomena are empty.
All phenomena are empty. And where's the fourth one? Yes, sir?
Nirvana is beyond extremes.
Nirvana is beyond extremes, or peace. Nirvana or peace or liberation is beyond extremes. So what's the first one again?
All compounded things are impermanent.
All compounded things are impermanent. Number two?
All emotions are painful.
All emotions are painful. Number three?
All phenomena are empty.
All phenomena are empty. And number four?
Nirvana is beyond extremes.
Nirvana or liberation is beyond extremes. So how do we put the... I feel like I've just received something from IKEA and I have to assemble it. Quick, get me an Allen wrench. Okay. And where's Alan? Ha, 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 ha. All compounded things are impermanent is the first one. And Dzongtsar Khyentse basically explains that every phenomena that we can think of is made of something else. It's compounded. And therefore, it's subject to impermanence. So that's his first statement. So if we think about his statement, it's actually kind of true. Everything is made of parts. There is nothing we can think of that exists of itself or by itself. It exists in conjunction with other things. And everything that we can imagine is made of parts. And those parts go into smaller parts. And those parts go into smaller parts. And those parts go, it just goes smaller and smaller and smaller. Even if we think of something vast, like time, it's vast. But if we try to bring it down to the moment of now, we can divide time into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. But now is always a moment that's just passed. We can't grasp now. Now is kind of an idea, but we can't truly grasp it. And so what he's saying here is that because everything is compounded, everything is impermanent. and always on the move. I know that I'm impermanent when I look in the mirror, and I see more wrinkles. I see more wrinkles, and I see gray hair, and I begin to realize I'm impermanent. Who knew? You know. And so as we age, we have to come to grips with impermanence. Our body hurts in ways that didn't hurt before, and we have unusual thoughts and things that happen to us. And so here's what Dzongsar Khyentse Rinpoche says about this. He says, he talks about the body being visibly impermanent, and he said, however, popular magazines cater to youth and beauty, and it exploits our attitude of wanting our body to be permanent and to be always beautiful. In terms of view, meditation, and action, the readers of these magazines might have a view, thinking in terms of not aging or escaping the aging process somehow. They contemplate this view of permanence, and their consequent action is to go to the fitness center and get plastic surgery and all kinds of other hassles. Enlightened beings would think that this is pointless and based on an incorrect view. I mean, really, somebody once said that Buddhism is where one of the key things about Buddhism is that we're trying to have people get real about what really is happening. And so if everything is truly impermanent and we truly believe that things are impermanent, then grasping on them will be less of a tendency, right? So here he says here, regarding these different aspects of impermanence, getting old and dying, the changing of the weather and so forth, Dzongsar Khyentse writes, Buddhists have a single statement, namely this first statement, all phenomena are impermanent because they are compounded. Anything that is assembled, like my IKEA furniture, will sooner or later come apart. And so he's saying everything, including every action we do, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so if we understand that, he says, we might ask, so what? So what if everything's impermanent? He says, it's not that Buddhists are really worried about beginning, middle, or end. The problem is, when there is composition and impermanence, there is uncertainty and pain. Where things are compounded and we attempt to paint permanence on something that's impermanent, it's almost like trying to stop the ocean from rolling in, or putting our hand up to the sky and attempting to stop the weather. It makes as much sense. And so he said, impermanence is not necessarily bad news. It depends on how you understand it. Recently, a friend of mine who works in the juvenile court system experienced some adversity in his life. And he quoted something that really helped me a lot. He said, I have to try to think of this adversity as opening up a new possibility. He said, what does this adversity now make possible for me? He could have grasped onto the uncertainty and thought about how the world is unfair and how his life was unfair and how everything was bad. And he could just grab onto that idea and go down the drain with it. But instead, he stopped and said, what does this now make possible for me? And that we had a conversation about this last week, and Kim, the director of our center, was saying that when the fire was burning down our center, she was on the phone with Kempo Carter Rinpoche, with his nephew, Lama Karma Drodol, translating. And Rinpoche was giving her advice on moving forward and being able to see that the fire in our center was not a tragedy in the way of being a permanent tragedy. Does that make sense? And so from that point of view, that the moment that we realized it was destroyed was the moment that an opening happened for us to do something we had wanted to do for a long time, which was to build the center the way we wanted it, to have what we needed to have for the people who come to visit us. And so it opened up that possibility. So impermanence is not necessarily bad news, if we can be open to that impermanence and what that impermanence can make possible. And it is a little bit difficult to go opposite to what we usually believe. And he says, he uses the example, Zong Sarkhense in his article, he uses the example of a new sports car. He says you get your brand new sports car and then you're scared to death of that first ding. I had a friend tell me that one of his friends bought a new motorcycle, and as a result of buying the new motorcycle, that he put his own first dent in it, his first scratch in the paint, so that nobody else would be responsible. He put it in a place where it wouldn't show. Okay, only he would know that the scratch was there, but then he didn't have to continuously be in fear that something was going to happen to that beautiful paint job. I actually kind of think that you might think that's a little weird, but I kind of think that there's some realism in that. Because if that was what it took to allow him to let go of wanting it to remain perfect always, which of course is unrealistic, then that would help. Does anybody have questions about this? All things are impermanent. Anybody think you found something that's permanent? I say that what?
I was just kind of being sarcastic, but I said, is that truth permanent?
Is that truth permanent? I have a feeling that that it is one of those things that is relatively true. Yeah, it's true for the time being. The Buddha taught on two levels. He taught on the relative level, which is kind of like the way things appear, how things look. And then he also taught on what was called the ultimate level. So from the ultimate point of view, nothing is as it appears. Nothing is it as it appears. But relatively, yeah, it's there. Let's use the wall as an example. Ultimately, it's made of atoms and molecules, and ultimately, it doesn't exist the way we think it does. But if I try to run into that wall, something is going to happen. And it's going to hurt me. So the Buddha taught on both of these levels. The relative level are the level of words. But the real Dharma is beyond words, as we will get to in number four. What's really interesting is that when Zong Sarkhense talks about these four, he says that they're in increasing levels of subtlety. Because the from the point of view of the fourth seal, nirvana is beyond extremes. In other words, the ultimate state is beyond existence and non-existence. So we're working our way there. But thanks for asking. You gave me a chance to give you a preview of coming attractions. So it's relatively real for right now, yeah. And then eventually, it's like a boat, you know. Somebody asked Kempo Rinpoche a question very similar to this once, my teacher. And he said, well, yeah, he says, I get what you're saying, he says, we actually need the teachings right now because he says it's like a boat. He says if we were to use your philosophy in real life, he said your philosophy is equivalent to saying I should be able to paddle my boat midway across a lake and then get out of the boat and walk across the top of the water to get to the other side. You know, you shouldn't need that boat, but there you go, and then you sink like a stone. He said the Dharma gets us to the other side and then we can discard it. Once we're liberated then, you see? It's kind of interesting. We need it for the time being.
Sorry, I don't want to take too much time, but the idea of the noumena and the phenomena with Immanuel Kant, how there's like the reality that's beyond our perceptions, but then there's the way that our brains filter reality. Mm-hmm. There's always limits on how we're going to perceive things.
Mm-hmm. I haven't studied Kant. You know, K-A-N-T, Immanuel Kant. Yeah. I haven't studied philosophy, but I can appreciate what you're saying about noumena and phenomena, the idea that what is ultimate is beyond expression and description, and that until we're there, we can't really take it in. Yeah. So I think what's interesting is that I think a lot of these philosophers had the same ideas. It's just that their formulation of those ideas attracted different people. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And that's why, and I think that's kind of why Zong Sarkhense is saying, I'm calling this Buddhist, but if anybody believes in these things, they believe in the path of the Dharma, whether they're Catholics or whatever. So that's pretty cool. Anybody else have something to say about impermanence? Okay. All right. Looks like I'm only going to be able to get through two of the seals today. Uh-oh. Well, we'll see if we can. We'll see if we can't get through them. The second one, who has the second one? Okay, very good. Go ahead and read that second one again.
All emotions are painful.
All emotions are painful. Once we accept that impermanence is part of life, that everything's impermanent, everything's in a state of change, we will begin to entertain the notion that we can begin to let go of things, of grasping at things, because and trying to make them permanent. We can kind of see the futility of that. Now, the second one has to do with our interior world. We might say, oh, well, external things may not be permanent, but my feelings, my emotions, those are real. My feelings and emotions, those are true. But actually, when you're sitting in meditation, you notice they don't last that long. And that if you have a distracting thought and then you let it go, it actually disappears unless you grab it again and try to bring it back. It's gone. Poof. And so while you might think that this statement is a little bit, shall we say, off base, all emotions are painful. What this means is when we react to the idea that everything is permanent, when we treat the world as though it is permanent, everything that any emotion that is born from that erroneous view is painful. Does that make sense? It's not that, you see what I'm saying? Because we're unenlightened beings right now, so we're living in that world where we are trying to fight the urge to think that everything is permanent. And so as a result, all of the emotions that arise are like the emotions we see when we watch preschool children fighting over toys, right? Have you done this? Have you been at a playground and watched the children fight over a toy? I mean, for adults, we look at that and we say, that is so adorable. They think that that toy is real, but it's not what they think it is. It's not as important as they think it is. And so we look at that behavior as being adorable, but then we go into a fight with a family member or a coworker or somebody, and then we it's like we fight to the death over an idea or over something. And so we leave behind that adorable notion, and then we try to believe that our emotions are somehow different because we're adults. Here's what Dzongsar Kensei says. He says, certain emotions such as aggression or jealousy, we naturally regard as painful. But what about love and affection, kindness and devotion, those nice, light, and lovely emotions? We don't think of them as painful. Nevertheless, they imply dualism. And this means that in the end, if we believe in that dualism, they are a source of pain. If we say, I must have that person in my life, I love them, or I must have that person in my life, and they must do what I say, and so forth. At that point, it's really not about love. We may have the feeling of affection for someone, but if we want to control them, that's not love. And so we have to kind of get real about what love is. The Buddhist definition of love is the wish for another person to be happy. And it implies a letting go, right there, a letting go of everything except their happiness. So the Buddha said, dualistic mind creates a lot of expectations, hope, fear. Wherever there is dualistic mind, there's hope and fear. I was talking to someone the other day about a new relationship they had in their life, and I said, you know, falling in love is kind of like a state of constant fear because you're always afraid the person will reject you and will not return the affections that you feel for them. In fact, the most people who I have talked to who consult their astrology, their horoscope, they're usually in love. And the answer is, will they love me back? I mean, the question is, will they love me back? Yes, sir.
Sorry to interrupt, but on this subject that popped in my mind, I like when Buddha said, when someone asked him about love, he said, if you love a flower, you don't pick it. You'll water it and just let it be.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting. It made me stop and think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How much?
Pick it and keep it,
you know? Well, yeah. How much of what we call love is really just a business transaction? Rinpoche said that one time. He said, we may think of love as being something special, but it's really just a business transaction. You do this for me, I'll love you. You don't do this for me, I don't love you anymore. And so this illustrates what you're talking about. And so all emotions being painful is to recognize that until we are in a place where we recognize the impermanence of everything, any kind of dualistic emotion based on our belief that we are real, things are real, and that we can own them is going to be a cause of suffering. Thoughts about that? Yeah.
Would it be the emotion itself that causes suffering, or the attachment to it?
And the questioner is asking, is it the emotion itself that's painful or our reaction to the emotion? And my take on that, I'll give you, I'm like one Buddhist, you know, so this is one Buddhist's take on that. My take on that is that the emotion probably arises as a result of our dualistic view. So yeah, I think from the heart of it, the minute that I realize that I am separate from the person I have the feeling about, or the thing I have that feeling about, I'm not resting with my mind as it is. I am positing that I exist separately from everything. Does that make sense? And so, yeah, you can almost see how they arise together. It's like the ignorance of knowing that we are, or thinking we are separate. The ignorance of that then immediately gives rise to me and the other, self and other. Once there's self, other is automatic. And then there's the drama, you know, self, other, drama. Because there's politics involved. I want control, or you see what I'm saying? So the emotion is, according to, what's really interesting is when the Buddha was teaching, this is me, not Dzongtsar, can't see him, but when the Buddha was teaching, he didn't put thoughts, feelings, and emotions in different categories, saying that emotions and feelings were somehow better or different. He actually called them all mental events. I'm having a mental event. You know, he called them all mental events, and then that they themselves would then create more reactions if we believed in them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I guess each of these, they all kind of depend on each other. So with the fourth one, that nirvana avoids extremes. Like, I could see how someone could go to the extreme of this one too and say, well, if all emotions are suffering, I'm just not going to feel anything.
Right. You would,
that's not healthy.
No, because there's still, yeah, because if a person were to say, "All, I'm just not going to feel anything, I'm going to become numb or stupefied," there's still self and other involved in that. I will become stupefied. Or, you know, it's like, you know, right? It as long as there's dualism, there's suffering of some kind. I mean, a lot of great literature is about people who try to who go to extremes to avoid suffering. Okay, I mean, okay, I never read The Secret Garden as a child. Did anybody here read it? It's about loss. It's about someone who can't live their life because they're living in grief for someone who died. And that someone comes into, a child comes into this person's life and changes their view and allows them to love again. And it's like, it's a weeper. You know, you read it, you watch the movie and you weep and, you know. But it's a lot of great literature is about the failure of people who try to hide from their suffering or try to deny the truth of their life. And the part of the drama for us as the audience is that we see the futility of them trying to hide from what's true. We want to go, no, get it, do it. You know, yeah, you'll be fine. We're yelling at the TV or at the book, you know. Get smart, you know, but it doesn't happen. Well, let's see. We've got 15 minutes. You want to think we should go for it?
Rocket?
Okay. Oh, we have one in the back. Yes.
So what's the lesson or message of the second seal?
Oh, to finish up the second seal? What I'm getting about it is to recognize, it, and thank you for asking that. What I feel is being said in this is when it says all emotions are painful, it's really asking us to cultivate a state of mind in which we recognize the root of all dualistic mental events, whether they're emotions or whatever, recognizing the root of them as being delusional. Thank you so much for asking. But recognizing that, it's almost like you have the option to ask yourself, where am I going with this? Instead of believing, if I have this thing in my life or this person in my life, then I will be happy. It's actually encouraging self-reflection, like, what am I doing here? And why am I asking for this? And why am I demanding this of myself? Why am I demanding, you know what I'm saying? It's like when we see ourselves going to an extreme, we like think, well, I have to go to this extreme. I have to do this. But the question is, are we allowed to question that assumption that because we want something, it's genuine? Or because we feel something that's genuine? By allowing ourselves to ask that question, we're getting closer to understanding the delusion and to seeing through the delusion. It's kind of like going and watching magicians. When you watch a stage magician, they won't tell you how they do the trick because they want you to suspend your disbelief in magic and for just a moment or two believe in magic. And so even for people who know it's a trick, they get fascinated with figuring out how they did it. But once you know that what's happening in your mind is based on a delusion of separateness of self and other, then you'll begin to question that. And it will allow you to become more free from the negative aspects of these graspings and emotions. Does that? Thank you. No, that's important. So thank you for that. And as Eric says, let's rock it. Let's go for the next one. Who's got the third one? Please recite it.
All phenomena are empty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all phenomena are empty. Now, this actually might sound kind of nihilistic. We were talking about Western philosophy. It might sound nihilistic. But if it really follows from the first one, if everything is impermanent, that means that nothing exists of itself and by itself. That wall did not create itself. Table didn't create itself. Even my emotions did not create themselves. They rise up like an ocean wave, they disappear and they fall apart. And so what this means is that nothing is permanently established and nothing is inherently existing of itself and by itself. Everything always, all things come from causes. This was one of the teachings of the Buddha, that there are no, there was a popular theory at his time when the Buddha was teaching, there was a popular theory that there were indivisible atoms that made up everything. They were the building blocks of everything with these indivisible atoms. And likewise, they believed in a soul, a spiritual soul that was created by God and would return to God. That was the belief, that after that soul was properly purified, it was made by God and it would return to God. And therefore, there was something that was permanent, which was God, and there was something permanent that was a part of that, which was our soul. You see what I'm saying? So the whole idea of indivisible atoms in phenomena is linked philosophically to the idea of an indivisible soul or an indestructible. And the Buddha kind of went sideways from that. He said, even our self-concept is always changing. And who we think we are changes from moment to moment, day to day, hour to hour. Who we think we are has changed in the last 5 minutes. I mean, seriously, nothing is remaining the same. Instead of saying that we had a soul, the Buddha said we had a stream of being that changed but was consistent, but that the consciousness of that was consistent through time, even though it changed. And that this was the carrier of all of our karmic development. He did teach that when we do think and say things, it becomes part of our stream of being, and that that stream of being then brings about our experience of the world. And that was really the basic teaching on karma. And so even his idea, so he said there's no indivisible particle. Everything is infinitely divisible. And there is no permanent self. So he said it's not that things are meaningless. That's not the kind of emptiness he was talking about. He was saying they're empty of reality. They're empty of solidity. They're empty of permanence. Does this make sense? Questions? Discussion? Yeah.
With this idea, is he saying that it's like the human mind that gives the substance to the objects? Like, you know, like idealism, like we're creating reality to be as to perceive. Something exists because we're perceiving it, but if it wasn't for the perception, it wouldn't exist.
Yeah, the questioner, I'm not going to be able to recite it back for the recording, perfectly, but the idea that that the perceiver in some way creates the object by perceiving it. And there are different schools of Buddhist thought that believe this, that when we leave this room, it's not here anymore. I mean, you know, literally. But whether we believe it that way or believe it in another way, it does come down to this, that nothing is established as creating itself. Nothing creates itself. Everything has existence only relatively and casually, but according to the rules. I mean, we can't go against physics. We live in this world that's governed by physics. But there's actually a place where physics stops being relevant. And some people say it's at the quantum, the very small level. But for the macro level, I don't want to run into that wall because it all breaks something. So yeah, we have to sort of respect the rules of where we are, which is why even though from the ultimate point of view, karma shouldn't work, from the relative point of view, it definitely does. And so if we disregard it, it's like running into that wall. It's taking unnecessarily dangerous action. When what we really could do with that information is go to number four, is go on to the fourth understanding, which is that the ultimate state is beyond any extreme of existence or non-existence. And Buddhist philosophy, particularly the philosophy called Madhyamaka or the Great Middle Way, they do this. They endlessly have you recite the teachings, you know, like, this is perfectly pure, and that is perfectly pure. They even say things like stupidity is perfectly pure, and this, you know, because they're trying to encourage a view that is beyond that. That kind of recitation kind of makes me unhappy. So I prefer to meditate instead, because that's within the laboratory of my own mind and body rather than philosophical argument bringing about an understanding. Although I don't want to disrespect that, because it actually works for many, 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 many people. So I'm not addressing your comment directly, but it's it is very similar to those philosophies that say that the perceiver changes what is perceived. It's kind of interesting. They're doing studies. I heard that they're doing studies about how far outside the body the human mind can be affected, which just really fascinates me. It's not about bending spoons or that kind of stuff, but it's kind of interesting. Yeah, there isn't a spoon. All right. So we will go ahead and go for number four. Don? Oh, I'm sorry. Justin, is that a question or is that a bug? Okay. Eric?
If you were to imagine that you had a pencil in your hand,
yeah,
you would think of it as a writing instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And your label would be that.
Mm-hmm.
If my dog saw that, he would imagine it as a chew toy and mm-hmm. label it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is really neither what this, but the utility, the relative utility of it has to do with
right.
what we project on it.
Thank you. That's perfect. Kempo Carter Rinpoche was talking about this one time, and he used as his example the glass of water. He said, for human beings, this is a beverage. This glass of water is a beverage. For a fish, it is an environment.
Yeah.
And it's life. It's the only environment they can live in. And they said that if a being with a delusion came in there, they might think it was fire. Or another being would come in, a dog with rabies would see it as danger. You know, so it's actually all of these beliefs projected onto it don't change what it is, which is number four, Don.
Nirvana is beyond extremes.
Nirvana is beyond extremes, meaning this state of liberation. From the state of liberation from belief in permanence, the state of liberation from belief in the permanence of phenomena or our internal mental state, the freedom from the delusive ideas about what was the third one?
Emptiness.
Emptiness. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Projection. Our delusions about projecting reality on things, and then if we are able to let go of all of those things, what remains is a state of openness and liberation, because we are liberated from those misconceptions. And that is why it is beyond extreme. Liberation is beyond the extremes of existence and non-existence. And this is why we practice meditation. And the practice of meditation is not necessarily about philosophy. It's about being able to experience ourselves as we are, our minds as they really are. Trungpa Rinpoche, I believe this was in his book, Vivid Awareness. He said, Buddhists can philosophize and argue and analyze and show that things neither exist nor that they can disprove existence and non-existence. They can do all of that infinitely. He said, but really the place where the proof comes from is in your own mind. In the end, you have to stop analyzing and start meditating. And he said, when you meditate, then the truth comes from within you and you see it. And then you'll never be fooled by dualism ever again. And this freedom from dualism and from delusion is the nirvana that is free from the extremes. So I guess there's not much to say. Which is in keeping with the theme, yes? Yes, I know. It's very interesting. Dzongtsar Khyentse says, yes, I know. He says, it seems that Buddhists are a bit slippery. And he said, from the ultimate point of view, the path is irrational. But relatively speaking, it's very rational because it uses the relative conventions of our world to point at something that's beyond. And then Dzongtsar says, when I am talking about emptiness, everything that I'm saying has to do with this image of emptiness. I can't show you real emptiness, but I can tell you why things don't exist inherently. And so even that little understanding is a form of freedom. And so that is what we are cultivating when we cultivate the quiet sitting meditation, is we cultivate the view in the laboratory of our own mind to know that clinging and grasping is the cause of suffering. And to know that relinquishing, clinging, and grasping is the source of freedom. And if we become familiar with that, as familiar with that as we are with our own mind, Trungpa Rinpoche says, it's your mind. It's your mind. It's how you experience things. He said, it's as close to you as anything. It's closer to you than anything. And so this is where you'll know it. And so this is why in the practice of Buddhism, we value the practice of meditation, because in essence, the teachings are just the framework, the philosophical framework that allows us to let go when we're on our meditation seat. We don't have to sit and say, is this a scam? Is this teaching on emptiness just a scam? And we will know philosophically that it's not a scam. And then when we experience ourselves in a different way, then we'll know it's truth. It's a truth that is beyond expression. So that's a... You guys are amazing. We found the Easter eggs of the four seals of Dharma. And we found that these beliefs... let's do it again. Number one. Who had number one? Okay, Chuja, you had number one.
All compounded things are impermanent.
All compounded things are impermanent. Who had number two?
All emotions are painful.
All emotions are painful. Number three?
All phenomena are empty.
All phenomena are empty. And number four?
Nirvana is beyond extremes.
Nirvana is beyond extremes. Being able to talk about these things is a relative way to point to something that is beyond, that is ultimate. And I'm really happy that we had a chance to share this little Easter egg hunt today. I have to confess that part of the reason I did this is because I have a hard time remembering all four. I can remember the Four Noble Truths really well, but these four seals of Buddhist philosophy that make whatever system believes in these four things points to liberation. Anything that's missing these four things, or missing even one of them, is not pointing to liberation. And so the idea is that if we can have these ideas and take them on and use them as a method to get us on the meditation cushion, that's the best. Well, we'll have to stop here. But let's sit quietly and do another relative practice. Relatively talking about these things is good. Ultimately, it's beyond all of those things. But we'll dedicate, we dedicate this merit, the merit and goodness of talking about these things, to the benefit of all suffering beings. May all beings gradually, in whatever way is best for them, come into contact with these truths. May they practice them and gain liberation. And then gaining liberation, may they emanate everywhere and liberate those who are not yet free. We'll mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling, or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.